calculation.
Okay, so I will thank Beth for inviting me to come here, and I will warn you that I am really the first chemist of the conference, and so I have almost no idea what to expect. What I've done is I've tried to find some sort of least common denominator in this talk, which means I'm going to insult everyone's intelligence at some point. If I don't insult your intelligence and I go over your head, then just stop me. I want to start by saying the main people who I've done this work with, and they're up on this slide. Dimitri and Helen are here, and since a lot of this work has actually been done in Belgium, probably I should say that if you ask me any questions at the end, I may, you know, just point at Dimitri or Helen and say, you answer that. They may well know better than I do. I also want to acknowledge the people in my group, and the people who I've colored here are actually at this meeting somewhere in the audience sitting here. And this is sort of the team of people at McMaster that are working on things that are related to this topic. So, now I'm going to really talk about the variational approach, but I want to start by just saying what the general philosophy that we have, and for a long, long time I've been interested in what I would think of, because I was trained as a density functional theorist, and I still do density functional theory, as generalized density functional theory. And that is, basically, instead of using the full wave function, we find something that nominally has less information than the wave function, but nonetheless we can use as a way to approximate the wave function. And there's a lot of names on this slide of people who've contributed to this sort of theory. Later on, some names will pop up during this slide. I've highlighted Levy and Savin as really the leaders of the idea that all of the mathematics that you have for density functional theory can be extended to this sort of object also. And so they've really done a lot on what we would call generalized adiabatic connections and things like this. The second thing I'll say is I'm really going to be interested in the variational approach to these density matrices and not this contracted Schrodinger equation, anti-Hermitian contracted Schrodinger equation. There's a reason for that from the standpoint of a chemist, which is from a standpoint of a chemist, all of the contracted Schrodinger equation stuff really is very closely related to these couple cluster methods here. In fact, the anti-Hermitian contracted Schrodinger equation was originally derived, at least more or less, by Kulcsonig and Mukherjee. Later, Garnet Chan sitting in the back did things. So really, it was sort of formulated in an alternative wave function language before the density matrix people got a hold of it. And so to me, I think most chemists, we prefer thinking about those approaches in this wave function language to the density matrix language. The variational approach to the density matrices, on the other hand, there isn't an obvious way to formulate it in a wave function language. So, as I said, I'm going to insult everyone's intelligence at some point, so I'm going to start by trying to insult everyone all at the same time. So this is the problem we're interested in chemistry. We have a kinetic energy operator. We have some sort of attraction of the electron to some sort of potential that's binding it. We just call it V. We call it the external potential. It just means it's external to the electrons. It's not from the electrons. And then we have some sort of repulsion operator. And the nice thing is it contains only one and two body operators, and all the electrons are identical particles. And the basic idea is we could really understand what two particles are doing, then because all the electrons are identical, we could sort of infer the key behavior of the other particles. And why do I say that this is sort of related to density functional theory and all of these things? It's because they really are based on the same idea. In DFT, they look at it and they say, well, the kinetic energy operator, it doesn't change. The electron-electron repulsion operator, it doesn't change. Therefore, the only thing that's changing is this. The only thing we need to evaluate this electron attraction term is the electron density. So we use this as our descriptor of the systems. At the cost of, we have to come up with some way of writing these two terms in terms of the electron density. Yeah. It's the ground state energy. So it's the ground state energy. So we can write it like this, where this is the ground state wave function of the system. Oh, because I made a typo.
And why do you have a delta 1 and a delta 2 in the kinetic energy?
Because I'm going to consider this is the Laplacian of the first particle and the Laplacian of the second particle.
Are they going to be
And, well, no, there's n particles, but then I multiply it times n over 2 at the end. So that's why I'm doing that. I'm just trying to keep everything symmetrical within the two particle space, basically, anticipating that I'm going for the density matrices at the end. So that's just why I wrote it. And you're going to see this extra complex conjugate over and over again because I just copied and pasted equations and modified them. So sorry about that. But yeah, you can obviously, I could just take one of them and multiply it by n because all the particles are identical, or I can take two of them and multiply it by n over 2. Right? It's just a way of writing it that comes in handy later. The alternative, and there's been a lot of work done on what we would call density matrix theories, and there you let the kinetic energy operator can be anything, so one body operator, that's the only requirement. You still say, well, this electron-electron repulsion is universal, and then your fundamental descriptor is this one electron density matrix, and there's unknown functionals for the electron-electron repulsion. So, again, that's a fine theory. You could say, on the other hand, this kinetic energy term, this is the part, this is universal. I'll allow a general repulsion operator. Now, the pair density, that's your fundamental operator. You have an unknown functional, which is your kinetic energy, and you also have an n-representability problem on top of it all, which makes matters rather unpleasant, but technically you can do this sort of theory. And then finally, the one we're interested in, which is now we're going to take a general two-body operator, any sort of two-body operator. In general, the one we're interested in will have kinetic energy, which are one-body kinetic energy operators, one-body electron attraction operators, plus a two-body repulsion, all multiplied out like this. This keeps my operator symmetric, which is why I wanted to write it in this funny form. Now, this two-electron density matrix is our key things. There are no unknown functionals, but there is this n-representability problem, which I'm just about to get to. I put unknown in quotes in both of these cases because technically how to deal with these problems is known, but it's unknown in a practical form. And in fact, you can switch this around, and that's why I gave these two references. If you say, I don't want to deal with n-representability, I hate n-representability, instead you can reformulate this in terms of unknown functionals, but no representability problem. So you have a choice, really, between a representability problem and a functional problem. My personal belief is that the functional problem is worse than the n-representability problem, but, you know, you can take your pick.
There is a difference. The functional problem doesn't have any nice underlying mathematical description to which you can hope for an answer.
I have no idea exactly what you mean by that. I will agree that the functional problem, what I would say is you can formally formulate it as a functional problem. Whether that functional is well-behaved or not, in fact, I know it's not well-behaved, and it's, in fact, in some sense, infinitely poorly behaved. I think the same thing is true with the n-representability problem. If you put on approximate constraints, I can always find you a density matrix. Well, I can always find you a system for which the error will be infinity. Right. In this sense, they're both really, really bad.
In terms of approximations, they may be really, really bad. But the problem with density functional theory is not only do you not know the functional, you don't even know its domain and range, in the sense that if you put reasonable conditions on the density, natural conditions for the kinetic energy, you know that the potential has to be highly singular for this functional.
Yeah.
And so you can't get any, nice...
No, I mean, I agree. And this, so the inverse problem of anything to the operator is horribly ill-defined, right?
For n-representability, it's well-defined. We just don't know the...
Well, but that's because you aren't trying to do the inverse type thing. So in practice, all the functionals have some sort of inverse thing. So the n-representability, you get around this issue in a way.
Well,
this will be. But largely, this has some reason to do why I don't like the approach we're using functionals. Right? So, okay, now, we write this notation in lots of different ways. We write this density matrix in this sort of way, where we just write it as a function of, I use z to mean space and spin coordinates, What is that? Well, I take a sum over an ensemble, so I take some weights between 0 and 1. I take some wave functions. I integrate out some of the coordinates, and I get back this second order density matrix. We usually write this in terms of an orbital basis, like Bob was saying. So we write it like this, and then we're really lazy. The way to get these coefficients is that you just apply them to this wave function. You just integrate out over them. And then we use this annihilation or creation operator. It's just notation as a way to mean multiply the wave function by these functions, integrate over the coordinates. And that's how we define these coefficients. So inevitably, when I'm writing this, I mean I took some ensemble of wave functions and then I did these operators, which meant integrate with respect to these single particle states. A big caveat that I think, in order to really be competitive with the sorts of things that other quantum chemistry programs are doing, and we aren't there yet by any stretch, the number of single particle states we need to be able to deal with is something like 200. Okay? It's a lot. So, the first thing you do, and it's the naive thing to do, is you just say, well, this is my energy expression. I'll minimize subject to the fact the number of electrons is right, and this thing had better be positive definite. Right? If you do that, you get some horrible numbers, about minus 18 Hartree. Change your basis, you'll get something a little bit different. This is really bad, but in fact, we shouldn't expect it to be good. Even in the one-order density matrix, this is a horrible number. So if you minimize the first-order density matrix functional with respect to keeping the trace right and only positive definiteness, all your electrons pile into the lowest single particle state. That's a horrible bound. And then matters get worse because you have positive energy states, usually, because you had a finite basis, and you start putting negative occupations in the positive energy states, and you get even more in the bottom energy state. So you do this, at least you get rid of the negative occupation, so you're bound, but you end up with n times the bottom energy eigenvalue. A good calculation, and what in fact is exact for the single particle, is you say, well, I'm going to force the density matrix and its sort of whole density matrix, so 1 minus the unit minus the density matrix. If both of those are forced to be positive semi-definite, the first order density matrix calculation is fine. And so a fair comparison of the second order theory and the first order theory would be, you say, now I'm going to make sure the normalization is right. I'm going to make sure the matrix itself is positive semi-definite. The matrix was defined with these pluses on the other side, so I'll just put the pluses on this side. Now, this is the whole matrix. This is what we call the Q condition. It comes from Coleman back in 1963.
That's from Garrod and Purkis. The Q condition is Garrod and Purkis.
I think the G is from Garrod and Purkis.
Right, the G.
Yeah, okay. The Q is from Coleman. And this gives you minus 14.61, which is 20 millihartrees below the full CI. So basically, that means this third digit is wrong. That you might think that's good. A quantum chemist will laugh you out of the room with 20 millihartrees. 20 millihartrees is fast on a chemical scale. We would convert this into kilojoules per mole, and now you're talking about, 10,000, some number like this, in the chemical scale. Yes?
What is a Hartree?
A Hartree. So the energy of the hydrogen atom is 1/2 Hartree. So it's a natural thing, so we don't have to keep track of our units, basically. Okay, so the real problem here, and this is what Bob has already said, is this density matrix has to come from some n electron or n fermion system. And basically, it's what we say n representable. This is the definition. Only if there exists some n fermion system that gives us back this density matrix. So here I take some anti-symmetric wave function, or some set of anti-symmetric wave function with some set of non-negative weights that add up to 1, and there must be some way to choose these wave functions and these weights that gives me back this density matrix. And the exact ground state energy is exactly minimize the ground state energy subject to the fact the normalization is right and that this matrix is then representable. That's not a useful formulation. And so the way I think about this is, here's my n-representable set. It's closed and convex. The exact n-representability conditions here are known, but I'd say they aren't known in a useful form. You can imagine if I had some non-n-representable density matrix, so it's outside my set, then I know that there's some element here that defines a hyperplane. Well, I choose this element, I minimize over the n-representable set, that gives me the ground state energy of this operator, which is a Hamiltonian. It's going to be greater than the expectation value here. So this is just a separation type argument. And the immediate inference from here is that a density matrix is n-representable if and only if, for every possible Hamiltonian, that density matrix gives an energy greater than the ground state. It has to be true for every Hamiltonian. That's not at all practical. We would like to get it now into this semi-definite programming form. That's actually pretty easy. We say for every positive semi-definite Hamiltonian, you may think you've made your life easier. It sounds like you have fewer Hamiltonians, but in fact all you've done is you've taken the ground state and sort of pulled it in. You've just changed the zero of energy. Yeah.
Can I just make a quick comment? The quantum information people, the first necessary and sufficient condition that you have a Hamiltonian is, in terms of convexity, completely analogous to the use of an entanglement witness to detect separability. Okay, it's the analogous convexity problem. Okay, sorry.
Okay, that's fine. So, is it impossible to do this for every positive semi-definite Hamiltonian? That's gigantic. So what do we actually do? Well, we use some class of positive semi-definite Hamiltonians. And this sort of formulation, this isn't exactly how Garrod and Perkis formulated, but they were the first people to formulate these necessary and sufficient conditions. So I have a more sort of fuzzy chemistry argument for this. And so you won't manifestly positive semi-definite Hamiltonians. We'll take an operator, square it. That's manifestly positive semi-definite. If I'm interested in two electron operators, there are really three ways of doing that. And so we take, this is the P, that was just the positivity of the density matrix. This is the Q, which is the thing that Coleman came up with. And now this is the G, which is from Garrod and Perkis. These coefficients here are forced to be anti-symmetric. This one isn't anymore. And now, here's beryllium. It's quadruple zeta basis set. This is a big basis set. And the full CI energy is, minus 16.401. Here's the P, Q, and G. We're off by 2 millihartries now. That's getting towards where a chemist would be happy. Most chemists would accept 2 millihartries of error for this. So I would say part of the game is finding better n-representability conditions. So conditions that go beyond these three, hopefully without breaking the bank computationally. So, let me go back here for a second. There's something sort of strange here, which is as my number of single particle states grows, the number of n-representability conditions I have grows, and also the flexibility in my density matrix grows. So there's some tension. You make a more flexible function, that should drive the energy down, and I'm adding more and more constraints, which pushes the energy up. So the question is, how do you get? Do you get convergence as you increase the number of single particle states? And how does that convergence compare to what a normal method would be? So here's what I've done. I've taken beryllium, and here's neon, and then silicon. And what I've done is done what we call it's a way of increasing the single particle states in a sort of systematic way. We call it double zeta, triple zeta, and quadruple zeta. It basically has to do with the amount of flexibility you have for your outermost electrons. And as you increase the basis, you see it looks roughly the same thing that you're doing with the quantum chemistry method. What I plotted here is the fraction of the basis set limit full CI energy. So if you like, this is the exact energy. And how are you approaching it? And one thing you'll notice is this was supposed to be a lower bound, but because our basis is too small, we never actually have gotten a lower bound. And so we're maybe approaching a lower bound here, but we aren't there yet. And in fact, one of the big problems here is it's seems impossible based on this to make a reasonable extrapolation to the infinite basis set limit, and that's very, very important for chemists. If we can't extrapolate to that infinite basis set limit, we can't really get good numbers most of the time. And that's a problem in this sort of theory that we're still dealing with. Another thing we always check is sort of a standard testing ground for density matrix things, is we want to make sure that it can do, let's say, beryllium and neon correctly. Why is that? Well, for beryllium, for four electron atom, as you increase the atomic number, so you make the nucleus more and more positive, the correlation grows linearly. And for neon, the correlation approaches a constant as you take a 10 electron atom and you increase the atomic number more and more. So a good classic method, so couple cluster singles and doubles, that scales the same way as the density matrix methods scale. It's closely related to this contracted Schrodinger equation approach. And it actually reproduces this okay. Here, I put the density matrix, this SDP is the semi-definite programming results, and it tracks these couple cluster very closely. It doesn't quite go linear, but that's actually just an imperfection in the basis set. That's because the 2s and the 2p orbitals are not perfectly degenerate, and they need to be perfectly degenerate. So the hydrogenic system doesn't have exact degenerate second principal quantum number 2 orbitals in this basis. If we fix it so they are, then we get this perfect linear behavior. That's one way of testing things. I said neon should go to a constant, and yes, neon goes to a constant. So again, I've plotted here are the different types of basis sets, double zeta, triple zeta, quadruple zeta. Here's the semi-definite and the couple cluster. And it tracks the couple cluster results. It basically says this looks like a good, solid quantum chemistry ab initio method. We actually aren't that interested in absolute energies in chemistry. We're much more interested in relative energies and changes in energy. Here's ionization potentials using something called the extended Koopmans theorem. The extended Koopmans theorem is a neat theorem for density matrix calculations because it says if you have the exact second-order density matrix, the extended Koopmans theorem spits out the exact Dyson orbital, so the exact electron removal state, and the exact ionization potential. And so the question is, how close do we get to this first ionization potential from our density matrix? If you like, it's a way of measuring the error in our density matrix. And in fact, the results here are actually very good, and they converge very quickly with respect to the basis. That makes us feel fairly good about our method here. So what about molecules? Well, this is a problem molecule. A lot of quantum chemistry methods, if you give it something like O2+, perturbation theory method, will just take this curve and it will just fall off to minus infinity at some point. This is a good way of breaking quantum chemistry methods. In this case, you see what Bob was saying. We get a curve that's closely parallel to these multi-reference CI and CAS-SCF curves, which is sort of a standard quantum chemistry way of computing this sort of problem. So at this point, you might be feeling really good, but here's an O+. So instead of, we just took one of the oxygen atoms and changed it to a nitrogen atom. And now the curves are not at all parallel. And it looks really good in equilibrium. It's sort of parallel in this region. And when you stretch it, it goes way wrong. I mean, it's wrong on the level of this plot, and a chemist would have a problem potentially even if it looked right to the eye. So the fact that it looks wrong to the eye is bad news.
Can you say what you're plotting there?
So this is energy versus bond distance. This is the distance between the two nuclei, and this is the energy.
This is in Born-Oppenheimer,
exactly. So, and what you see that's gone...
White is full CI, I guess.
What this is complaining to multi-reference CI. Okay. So it's an into-the-sixth method, which is nice. It's an into-the-sixth method that takes an expert to run, which is bad. It's sort of an inspired into-the-sixth method, you might say. And in fact, it's fairly expensive. So this is our curves. This you can accept as the right answer, basically. And the problem is that you're dissociating to species with fractional numbers of electrons. This dissociation limit here is nitrogen plus oxygen plus. And this is not nitrogen plus oxygen plus. In fact, every molecule in chemistry, if it has two different atoms in it, dissociates the integer charges. And this is a qualitative failure of this theory. Adding the T1 and T2 constraints really helps you near equilibrium. It doesn't improve this dissociation thing. It improves the dissociation energy at the millihertz level. You won't actually see a change in the curves at dissociation. So this is happening for all the heteronuclears except for group 1 and group 2 elements. So hydrogen, helium, lithium, beryllium, sodium, magnesium. Why are these special? Well, they're basically 1 and 2 electron systems. There's a closed shell, and then there's 1 and 2 electrons loosely bound outside them. And so for things with more than 1 or 2 electrons in one of the atoms, you end up seeing that the dipole moments, that's the essentially the charge on these two species, it goes way wrong as you stretch the molecule. So here's the multi-reference. That's the reference at 10 angstroms. Here's the density matrix at 10 angstroms. Here's the density matrix at 20 angstroms. This doesn't really change from 10 to 20 all that much. It just sort of scales. These are really qualitatively wrong. The dissociation energies here are badly wrong. Even for nitrogen, which is symmetric, there's no problem with the charges. But this is something that Maho Nakata already had pointed out, that there's a size consistency error. You don't dissociate into the correct neutral atoms. And here you get something, this is 129 millihertz. This is, yeah, totally unacceptable by any. This is borderline for a chemist, and so this is 100 times borderline. Right. So the main problem here is what the exact curve should have some sort of discontinuity at the integers. So the exact curve of the energy versus the number of electrons needs to look like this. And I'll explain to you why it needs to look like this, but this is the correct behavior, and the actual semi-definite program gives this sort of smooth curve, and that basically is saying if you're at this point and you have a nitrogen atom that's neutral, it is very happy to just give up a fraction of an electron or don't accept or donate a fraction of electron. It takes zero energy to do that. With a discontinuity, it takes a chunk of energy to strip away or add an electron. And so one way of checking this is we just add together the E versus N curves for nitrogen and oxygen, add them up. We get a parabola or something that's very close to a parabola. We minimize this energy versus number of electrons curves. We get something that's very similar to what we got back from the semi-definite programming. So we can sort of feel confident that this, in fact, is what's happening. That this, well, this is supposed to have the energy there. But the energy difference between this model, which is really only accurate at infinity, and what's actually happening at 10 angstroms, is about 2 millihertz. And the populations are very close. So this is really what the issue seems to be in this case. So let me see if I can explain to you why this is, what's the issue here. So what's the correct behavior for this energy versus number of electrons curve? So I'm just going to start with two systems, A1 and A2. They're exactly the same. I stretch them to infinity. And now I'm going to add one electron to a system. And so I'm going to form a totally symmetric wave function. I'll add one electron to the first system or add one electron to the second system. I mean this hat to mean just take the anti-symmetric product of these two things. So I anti-symmetrize all the electrons in these two, so this is a nice Pauli principle satisfying wave function. The energy of this subsystem, well, it's just the energy of N0 electrons and the energy of N0 plus 1. So you average, well, the energy of the total is the 2, is not the 1/2 there. It's just the total. But the energy of the subsystems, if you like, well, I've stretched the molecule to infinity. My electrons, in some sense, are distinguishable particles now because they're infinitely far apart. I know you're shaking your head. This is the way we think about this because you stretch them infinitely far apart at this point. You have two subsystems. And this N plus a half electron system ends up having, if you like, half the energy of these two. This is sort of a sloppy way of reasoning without actually invoking a grand canonical ensemble, which is the other way of doing this. This is only true if this E versus N curve is convex. No one's ever proved that it's convex. If you have repulsive forces R to the minus K, then yeah, I can prove a bound on the convexity that says if it's just a little bit harder than a 1 over R repulsion, then it ends up being that it's not convex. I would postulate that this bound is probably tight, but I don't think anyone knows whether that bound is tight or not. We can take this same argument and go to many more electrons. We just take the wave function, we take the anti-symmetric product of all the possible ways of assigning some extra number of electrons onto some number of sites. We take them infinitely far apart, and we end up finding that these subsystems, in order to dissociate molecules correctly, they have to have sort of this sort of energy. And this is basically just sort of an ensemble approach. We're building the ensemble one copy at a time. And all of this approach, you can sort of find these and sort of these references. It's standard, goes back to Purdue, Parr, and Levy in 1981, at least in this context. The bad news is if you miss the dissociation curves, if you don't get this integer discontinuity, all sorts of things fall apart. So basically, if you miss this integer discontinuity, you can say your theory is worthless for chemistry. So you get the wrong dissociation products, I already showed that. You'll get incorrect spectroscopic constants, so you can't predict the spectrum. That's bad for a chemist if you can't predict the spectrum. You get incorrect atomization energies, which basically is just a different way of saying you got the wrong dissociation product. So you take a molecule and you break it into its atoms. This is how we often define the heats of formation of a molecule. And so it basically means a lot of the thermodynamic properties of the molecules go crazy. The polarizability of it is too large. The reaction barriers in chemical reactions end up being far too small and often inconsistent. So that means when you try to actually do a chemical reaction, you predict the energy it takes to do the chemical reaction is not big enough. And that means that the rate you predict for the chemical reaction, which depends exponentially on the barrier, so it's extremely sensitive to a small error in the barrier, this is what they measure in the lab, and it means you'll be off by orders of magnitude. So you're orders of magnitude off on the chemistry, basically. And the charge transfer energies, it's another thing that chemists really care about, those are qualitatively incorrect. So basically, if you have this problem, yeah, your theory falls apart. We have a way of fixing it. I won't claim it's necessarily the most elegant way of fixing it. If we wanted to fix it the brute strength way, so the way Bob talked about where you go to higher and higher order conditions, for NO plus, it would take 7 index conditions. So that's 7 index conditions, scales like what? The number of one electron basis functions to the 21st power or something of this sort. It's absolutely horrible. We have a trick that allows us to at least address this problem, which is that we define a density matrix for a subspace. So basically we take the second order density matrix and we say, here's some set of indices we care about for some reason. In our case, these set of indices will be the basis function centered on an atom. If the indices are all inside this subspace, then we let the density matrix have its value. Otherwise, we set it equal to 0. So as long as one of the indices of this quantity was not in the subspace, then we would just set that matrix equal to 0. So it's a chunk of the density matrix. And then, in order to define the one electron density matrix, we take the full two electron density matrix and we trace over all the single particle space. So now this J index goes over the whole basis, not just the subspace. And that gives us a one electron density matrix. You can do the same thing for any one or two electron operator. So if I have a normal energy expression with one electron piece, I can get a subspace expression like this. A two electron piece of the energy, I get a subspace expression like this. This is an energy on the subspace, and it has to be greater than or equal to the energy of the fractional number of electron system, where the number of electrons is the trace of this one matrix. How do I define the number of fractional electrons? Well, the same way I was describing earlier. You do the straight line. So you put the right curves into the theory as a constraint. And now you're forcing yourself to be above it. If I go back here, oops, hit the wrong way, I'll be forcing myself to be above this line or not to be below this line using this construction. And in fact, that's exactly what we do. The Hamiltonians we are interested in are the Hamiltonians of the atoms in our system. The subsystems we're interested in are the basis functions that are centered on those atoms. We usually expand our basis with just like Gaussians or Slater-type functions, so exponential-type functions that are with the center of the exponentials on the atoms. We obtain a lower bound on the fractional number of electrons energy. We don't know how to solve the fractional number of electrons problem, but we do know that the density matrix problem will give us lower bound. So we solve the density matrix problem for the integer numbers of electrons, and we use that to construct a lower bound on the fractional numbers of electrons. And that gives us the lower bound that we can use. And now we solve the molecular problem with some extra constraints. And these are a very special class of very high index conditions. The very high index behavior coming in the fact that this energy thing is sort of a high index thing. So this additional constraint basically by construction forces dissociation limit to be right. It forces size consistency, which is something that chemists really insist on. I think probably incorrectly, but chemists insist that, you know, when you have an energy of, so disjoint separated systems, so systems at a dissociation limit, the sum of the subsystem energies has to be the energy, the sum of the individual isolated components evaluated separately. And if we add on this constraint, then this is my NO plus curve all over again. This was the result without the constraint. Now this is the result with the constraint. And now the curves are very closely parallel. So it's a way of fixing the problem, if you like. When I do this, these are my energies at different bond lengths. These are the exact energies from multi-reference configuration interaction, so exact, very accurate energies. And what you notice now is now you actually do end up with something that's, yeah, it's sensible. Here you were definitely seeing a big change as you were separating things. Now things are sort of stabilizing nicely. So at this point you are actually getting a reasonable picture. You're going towards something that's shifted by a constant from the exact answer. We never expect to actually get the right curve in this without paying too much. Yeah. This here?
Yes.
Why is this so small? I think it probably goes back to the fact this is a dissociative curve, right? This isn't a bound curve. It's a repulsive curve at long range. Right, it doesn't look like the normal one, right? It looks like this. So in fact, this is a metastable molecule. It isn't actually, it isn't a bound. The dissociation energy is negative in our words. So you expect that to sort of look weird. Yeah, the subsystem by construction, you get the size consistency. You essentially put it on by hand. That's the inelegant thing about it, is we knew what one thing was wrong, and then we forced it to be right. There is no sort of inspiration in this. It's just sort of a brute strength approach. I think deriving it in any way other than the brute strength approach probably is extremely, extremely difficult. In fact, my guess is that it's an index restraint. So the dipole moments now end up looking pretty close to the correct answers from the multi-reference CI. And importantly, things like carbon monoxide, which we know should dissociate to have zero dipole moment, it dissociates to have zero dipole moment instead of a dipole moment that goes towards infinity as you stretch the bond further and further. So I want to say a few words about how we actually implement this in our program. There are a lot of algorithms here, and I'm sort of running out of time, so I'm just going to sort of skip through these. Basically, here's a more sort of conventional semi-definite programming. There's also a later semi-definite programming algorithm that came out of Matt Ciotti that was more conventional. There's a a linear, which is a nonlinear constraints algorithm, which is also sort of a, not a standard, but it's a trick in semi-definite programming. There's a dual space algorithm. There's our algorithm, which I'm going to compare, but I want to just sort of start with the smell test on what we actually need as chemists. The basic accuracy of this sort of thing using a second order density matrix with P, Q, and G will be similar to something like couple cluster singles and doubles. And it means that the scaling has to be like k to the 6 with respect to the one electron basis set, or the dimension of this matrix cubed, so the number of columns in the matrix cubed. And the computational prefactor needs to be small enough so that you can do about 200 one electron basis functions, which means that the number of rows or columns in your density matrix is on the order of 10,000, right? It's not a small problem that we're usually interested in. The way we do it is a very sort of standard log barrier approach. So here's our energy. We know that we want these matrices to be positive semi-definite. And we know that as these things approach a zero eigenvalue, then the log of the determinant goes to minus infinity. If we multiply it by a minus sign and some penalty, it goes very rapidly up towards infinity. So this is a penalty that keeps us inside the allowed region. And then we just have to take the limit as this penalty goes to zero, because, of course, the objective function we're trying to actually optimize is just the energy without the penalties on it. And we look at these just as mappings of these density matrices, because they're just functions, linear functions of the density matrices. And we, and I think everyone else who works on this, express this density matrix not in terms of these fundamental electron, one electron basis functions, but anti-symmetric combinations of them. And so we use what we call a geminal basis, already protected here. And that makes the math a little bit easier. So basically, we have to, the ground state energy is we, it should be a minimum, we minimize this quantity, this F, and then we take the limit as the penalty strength goes to zero. And the nice thing is for this objective function, in fact, the gradient, and while the Hessian is hard to construct, the action of a Hessian on a vector is easy to construct. And for instance, just to give you some idea of how the math goes, here's the way you evaluate the gradient here. You just use sort of the standard formulation that when you take the derivative of a log, you end up with the inverse of the thing inside the log, right? This F is just the matrix, which has one element, the IJ element, not is one, everything else is zero. And then you can use the fact this is a Hermitian matrix to write this in a more, maybe a nicer form, where you have something times the F in all the terms. So you just sort of do the manipulation. This ends up being a fast operation to do in your computer. And then we do what is on the surface, just a very simple idea. We just guess the density matrix for some penalty strength. We compute the Newton step. We use truncated Newton for this. We don't want to actually construct this Hessian and solve this linear equation exactly. That would cost us into the 12th. That wouldn't be competitive. We do this at into the 6th by using this sort of truncated Newton. So we solve this equation iteratively, not explicitly. We perform a line search in this Newton direction that we computed from this step. If we converged, we go back to step 2. Well, if it's not converged, then we recompute this. So if the Newton iteration hasn't converged, we compute a new Newton step. If the Newton iteration has converged, then we change the T, we make it a little bit smaller, and we go back to the first step. In practice, the first thing, which is guessing the density matrix, it isn't much of a problem. We extrapolate from the solutions of some of the previous values of T, we get a pretty good guess. Because we actually have a pretty good guess, it turns out that the line search in the Newton direction works very well. It doesn't take very many Newton steps for us to converge. So the Newton steps aren't our problem. The problem is this computing the Newton step direction. So this solving this linear equations iteratively, we've had huge problems with this. We still have huge problems with this. We've tried preconditioning this in various ways. We use conjugate gradient or MinRes. Right now we're using MinRes. We've tried just totally eliminating this using some sort of limited memory quasi-Newton, but evidently if you start throwing away the vectors in your quasi-Newton, then everything, you don't keep enough to actually make it work. So it does, To say it doesn't work is only to really point out that the limited memory variant, which is the only practical form for us, doesn't work. So let me just summarize. So the exact and representability conditions for this second order density matrix are known, and there's a systematic way, which Bob has already talked about, to derive the full set of n representability conditions. The bad news is if you don't impose the exact n representability conditions, there always exists some system for which there's an arbitrarily large error. So if you give me P, Q, and G, I can always find you some system where the error is 1 million Hartree. That's not a problem. The good news is that system may not be electronic, so it may not be something we care about. The bad news is it may be electronic. We don't really know. The good news is that basis set stability seems to be okay. The bad news is we still can't get to a big enough basis set to actually get the lower bound on the exact energy that we've been promised. The good news is this very simple positivity type constraints give good results for the atomic energies and for the single electron properties, and that we can get some chemical intuition out of this extended Koopman's theorem. And the bad news is that for molecules, these heteronuclear diatomics, we have a qualitatively incorrect dissociation. Good news is this subspace representability constraint fixes this dissociation product, and it also improves a little bit some of these near equilibrium regions. The bad news is that the number of subspace representability constraints grows as the number of atoms factorial. That's getting us back into the bad news. We can do the calculations with the type of scaling we would like in order to be competitive with quantum chemistry methods. Unfortunately, this prefactor is huge, and the current methods that we have are just not competitive cost-wise with these standard quantum chemistry methods. They're, in fact, non-competitive by close to a factor of 1,000. Okay, that's all I have.